On this week's 51%, we recognize Veterans Day and speak with Edie Meeks, a veteran of the Army Nurses Corps who was one of roughly 10,000 nurses to serve in the Vietnam War.
When we go to war and we send our warriors over, these are people. They are not just numbers, and they aren't some fictional, you know, hero that will bounce back up.
I'm Jessie King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh leader. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jessie King. Veterans Day is November 11th. Our main guest today was one of the roughly 10,000 women to serve in the Vietnam War. Now, you may be thinking, Jessie, women weren't soldiers during the Vietnam War, but they were nurses. From 1968 to 1969, Edie Meeks was a member of the Army Nurses Corps, where she worked in the intensive care units of the 3rd Field Hospital in Saigon and the 71st Evac Hospital in Pleiku. Upon returning to the U.S., Meeks embarked on a more than 50-year career in nursing, but she refrained from speaking about her time in Vietnam. That is, until her old hooch mate, Diane Carlson Evans, called about her plans to build the Vietnam Women's Memorial, which was dedicated in Washington, D.C. in 1993. Now at the age of 81, Meeks speaks widely about her experience in the Army Nurses Corps. She's featured in a new episode of the PBS program, After Action, in which she swaps stories with other Vietnam nurses from different branches of the military.
He was 26 years old, and he had 3 kids. I am so sorry that we couldn't save him.
On After Action, called We Were There, the episode aims to shed light on the contributions women made to the war effort. I stopped by Meeks' home in Beacon, New York for a preview.
Diane Carlson Evans gave them my name, and she is the president and founder of the Vietnam Women's Memorial. And so we have been friends. We were hooch mates in Pleiku for 6 months, the last 6 months we were in country. And so we're both from Minnesota, and we've been buddies ever since.
What was it like being able to do the episode, I guess?
It was really quite interesting, actually, because I had talked to a lot of Army nurses, and there were 2 Air Force nurses there. And so their whole practice was different than ours was. We had a longer contact with, not that it was long, but a longer contact with our patients than they did. I mean, they had them on the flight, and then that was it. But it was very interesting hearing what they went through.
Tell me a little bit about why you decided to enlist, because you volunteered.
Yes. Well, my brother, I have 2 brothers, 2 younger brothers, and my one that was 2 years younger than I am was drafted, and instead of joining the Army, he enlisted in the Marine Corps. And so I figured that if something happened to him, I wanted somebody over there who wanted to be there, because then they would really do a good job. And so then I called him and told him that I had joined the Army Nurse Corps. And he said, "What a relief." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because the Navy takes care of the Marines." So he was relieved that his sister wasn't going to be bossing him around.
I mean, in terms of like when you went over there, I'm sure you get asked this all the time, but like, what was it like when you first got there? And what was the process, I guess, of getting out there?
The flight was like 22 hours. You know, we stopped in Alaska and then flew from there. And actually, it was kind of interesting because on the way over, there were a whole bunch of soldiers on the plane. And I think there were maybe 2 females on the plane. And we were both nurses. And the feeling was kind of like we're going over to help. And on the flight coming back, it was a totally different feeling. It was one of shock and horror, you might say, and discouraged. They were all very discouraged, I think, and deflated, because Americans really do want to help. And these kids were young. I mean, the average age was between 18 and 23, whereas the average age in World War II was 26. So we had a lot younger crew going. And they were idealistic and they wanted to help and, you know. And then they got over there and it was like a year of living a nightmare. Because it was so out of their context of anything that they had ever known. Same with me. I mean, I had done intensive care nursing. I'd done ER nursing, you know, before I joined. But nothing prepares you for that, for having perfectly healthy young men come in all blown up for no reason. So that was the anger that I felt at the beginning was almost overwhelming. The rage that it finally came to be rage. And then I thought, okay, this was about October. I thought, okay, you can't live like this. You have to do your job. And that was when I just shut down. I figured if I don't feel anything and I just do my job and do it well, then that'll be fine. But that's really when I shut down for a long, long time, until maybe 20 years after I came home.
I was going to say, like, you know, like when you feel that rage, like, what do you do with it?
That's it. And you couldn't do anything with it. I mean, it was the kind of thing where I remember one time in the intensive care unit, actually it was in the recovery room because it was recovery on one side, intensive care on the other. And this fellow had like two legs blown off and we weren't sure if he was going to be able, he had a trach. And this colonel comes in and pins a Purple Heart on him. And it takes your breath away because you think to yourself, is this an even trade? I mean, it didn't seem like enough for what this kid had given up. So it was really difficult, especially since I had never gone through anything like this, where day after day after day, you kept seeing these horrendous wounds, and it was for no reason. It was because the Army was putting them in harm's way, and to the Army, they were just numbers, but to us, they were people. I mean, we knew that they were people, and we knew that they had families, you know, and we knew that they had mother and father and sisters and brothers and wives and kids. So it wasn't just a number. I think that was the thing that made it the most difficult.
I'm trying to imagine myself between 18 and 23. I didn't know anything between right. 18 and 23. Yeah. And then to be thrown in that situation, like, I can't even imagine it.
Well, I remember when we went to the Vietnam Women's Memorial, my daughter went with me. She was in college at the time. And she came back to the room and she said, Mom, there are still guys down by the wall and they're still dressed in their fatigues. What's that about? And I said, Gwyneth, let me put it to you this way. If you had your brother, the most he's camped is sailing down the Delaware with the Cub Scout troop or the Boy Scout troop. And I said, if he was taken from our home at 18 or 19 and put in Vietnam where you live in fear for a year, especially if you were out in the bush, I mean, you didn't know what was coming at you. And seeing people that you knew and grew really close to being killed or maimed, you would not come back the same person. And it would only have been a year, and your brother would have been a totally different person.
For you, I guess, how did your service change you?
Oh, boy. Well, the first thing I would say was, I went over there, I think, pretty much trusting my government and trusting the Army, and I left with no trust at all. I didn't feel that the Army valued the soldiers that they had, because these were my brothers, right? I didn't feel that the government valued its citizens, because these kids were citizens. And therefore, I had lost all of that trust. And then you come back and you can't tell anybody. Because at that time, in 69, July of 69 when I came back, I mean, that was the height of the anti-war movement. And so you didn't tell anyone that you had been there because you didn't want to have to get into a big argument. And it wasn't even the argument about the war, because at that time they were blaming the soldiers instead of the people they should have blamed, which was Congress and the president. So to hear somebody blame these kids who had been drafted or and went over there to do their duty because they had been asked to by their country, and to hear them blamed or not valued was really difficult. So I just kept my mouth shut. I wasn't going to get into it because I knew how special they were.
Did you have to see your brother deal with that as well?
Actually, my brother has never talked about it, ever. So, and that's okay. That's between him. He's going to the VA, goes to the VA, and he gets help. Everybody deals with it differently. And thank heavens that there are lots of different ways of doing it. You know, especially now with these veterans who have come back. There's, because of the Vietnam veterans, PTSD was actually diagnosed. Before it was shell shock and you were supposed to shape up, you know. And once these young men came back and couldn't cope, it's interesting too because the suicide rate of Vietnam vets, even as they get older, was very high. You would think by that time, oh yes, well, they've dealt with it. Well, unless you've really talked it out or belong to a group that talks about it, I mean, without Diane and working for the Vietnam Women's Memorial, I don't know what I would have done. Because she was really the one that got me into thinking about, talking about, valuing our service. Not only being a great friend, but she was really saved my life.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the Women's Memorial and stuff and how that got started. So I guess when did she start reaching out to you about that and how did that come together on your end?
Well, it started because she went to the dedication of the Vietnam Memorial. And she noticed that nothing was mentioned about the women who served over there. So she told me, I went to a psychiatrist 6 times and it didn't do any good. So I thought, I think we need a memorial. And she's quite a gal. I mean, just an amazing woman. She called me up and she said, we need somebody on the East Coast to help us out. I said, Diane, I don't know how you can talk about it. God bless you. You know, I'll send money, whatever, but I cannot talk about this. And so she would just keep calling me and we chat as we would before. And little by little, finally, toward the dedication of the memorial. And by the way, she had a terrible time trying to get money for this memorial. I mean, you would be surprised at how many men fought it.
Why fight it?
I have no idea why. But I know that the gentleman that started the Vietnam Memorial felt that the Women's Memorial should not be there. It is right next to the wall now, which is appropriate because the women there all backed up the guys who went, mm-hmm. You know. It was close to the memorial when the dedication, when she asked me if I would speak. Some of the press wanted to talk to people, and I said, okay, under one condition, that I can stop anytime I need to. Mm-hmm. And she said, okay, we'll tell them that and make sure. And slowly but surely, I started talking about it. One of the things also that helped me quite a bit was when my daughter was going to Mount Holyoke College, which is an all-women's college, and they had a fellow there who taught a course on Vietnam, and he would start his course by saying, you women will never know what it's like to serve in war. Well, my daughter said, I beg your pardon. And so she actually was taking a course on the 60s, which I said, is that history already? You know, this was in the 90s that this happened. And so she asked her professor if I could come and speak during the time that they were studying Vietnam War. And he said, yes. And so I went and I simply said to them, I don't know about the politics, but I'll tell you what it felt like to be a woman there. After, there was a little gal that came up to me and she said, oh, Mrs. Meeks, I would have welcomed you home. Mm-hmm. And to me, it was like such a healing kind of thing. I think, too, one of the reasons why it was so healing was because it was women listening to women. Mm-hmm. And those women were used to listening and valuing what women had to say. Because even now, sometimes you have to explain why you're there if it's a men's group. And so from then on, I just did whatever Diane needed. And then she put me on the board of directors, and I was on that until we finally gave over the memorial to the Parks Department.
I'm just kind of thinking about like what you said, that like, you know, you have to almost explain why you're there when you're in veterans groups and stuff. I guess when you were out there, though, like, I mean, it was pretty clear why you were out there and stuff like that. What was it like being a woman in that kind of environment? I guess, were there a lot of nurses out there? Like, were you able to be with other women, or was it mostly you with other men?
Oh, no. Every place that you lived in a group situation with other women who were also nursing over there. Mm-hmm. I think it was because, first of all, in my generation, one of the things I have to say is we were nurses that took care of the soldiers, but we were not actually soldiers. We were not allowed to carry weapons. I mean, we could qualify on the M16 if we wanted to, which I did, but today's nurses really are soldiers. I mean, they have to go through basic training. You know, our basic training, it was like when I called my brother who had gone through Marine boot camp, which was like hell on wheels, and I said, well, Tom, I don't know what you were talking about. I mean, you know, the maid came in every day and made the bed. He couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. But today the maid doesn't come in to make their beds, mm-hmm. you know. So it was a different kind of thing. And also when Diane was putting this together, she called the Pentagon and she said, I would love to have a name of the women who served over there so that I could get, you know, get them together. And they said, no women served over there.
What?
They hadn't kept track of us as women serving someplace. Mm-hmm. They had just thrown our names in the pot, I guess. So they had no idea. And so we had to do a sister search, which was connecting people and then see if they knew of people and tried to connect as many as we could to try and find our sisters.
Looking at, I guess, how women are treated in the military today, are you noticing much of a difference, I guess? Have things improved from your perspective?
Oh, boy. The thing that really got to me with this Iraq war, Afghanistan, is that they were sending them back more than once. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's cruel and unusual punishment. And the only reason they're doing it, I think, is so they don't have to institute the draft. Because if they did, we'd be out of there. I mean, that's why, one of the reasons why Vietnam finally stopped. And I think that that's one of the reasons why the Iraq-Afghanistan war went for 20 years. Was because there was no draft. But when you come back from a war situation, you are different. And if we had to go back two or three times, we really would have been different. And they did a study for women anyway, I'm sure they must have for men, but for women, and what they found was of women who had served in Vietnam, that chemically their brains changed. I mean, a year of constant stress like that chemically changed their brains. And that's not something you snap out of. You know, you have to learn how to deal with it. And I remember when that war started, and the Army came up with, oh, and when you come back, we'll have all the PTSD dealt with within 2 years. I thought, these people are idiots. So. It took me 20 years to even be able to go to get some help. And that was true of a lot of people. You know, they had to get on with their lives, and then as their life was slowing down a little bit, all of a sudden they were hitting that brick wall that they had to deal with.
I mean, in terms of, like, I guess from your colleagues and stuff, what do you remember most about them? What was it like working with them?
Oh, my gosh. I saw some of the best nursing that I've ever seen. And but also some of the best. Everybody put on their A game every day. I mean, the corpsmen were amazing. And the doctors did surgery that, you know, was incredible. I mean, it was the kind of thing. We worked 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. But if you needed to be there longer, you stayed. You know, it was a team effort, and we all worked together as a team. Mm-hmm. And that's just the way it was, you know. But in a way, it was kind of difficult coming back because you never find that teamwork ever again. Mm-hmm. What we had there was a common purpose, which was to take care of our guys. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to give them the best care we possibly could. And we all worked to give them the best care and to get them back to the States, to their families. Whereas nursing and medicine is totally different stateside. The patients are different, for one thing, you know, and it's not that total common cause that you're all working for. And I think that a lot of soldiers feel that as a difficulty too, coming back, in that they have been such a tight-knit group together, and then all of a sudden, teamwork where you work where you don't even have to talk to each other. Mm-hmm. You know what's going to be happening, yeah, and what you, where you fill in. And then you come back and you don't have that. And for a lot of soldiers, that's really tough not to have that closeness.
This episode is for the PBS show is airing around Veterans Day.
Ah, okay.
What do you hope viewers take away from that episode? And what do you hope maybe people take away from your story and your service?
Oh, boy.
That's a big question. I'm sorry.
No, it is a good question, though. I guess, for me, what I'd like people to understand is that when we go to war and we send our warriors over, that these are people, that they are not just numbers, and they aren't some fictional, you know, hero that will bounce back up. That these are our kids, and they're our brothers and sisters, and that they are going to come back differently. If we send them, we ought to take care of them. And there, one of the things that was so difficult was when you apply for disability with the VA, they give you such a hard time, and you feel so injured by them not accepting your story. I'm sure they have some kind of, you know, list that they go down. Mm-hmm. But we aren't lists. Mm-hmm. We're people. And we've served over there. And we all can deal with it differently, mm-hmm, on different levels. And so if you've served, they should say yes to everything. Yes, you should have the best care. Yes, you should be given compensation if you can't work. Yes, we believe you. Mm-hmm. Don't just send them over there and then drop them and think it's okay, because it's not.
Edie Meeks is a retired nurse and veteran of the Army Nurse Corps, where she served as an intensive care nurse during the Vietnam War. She's featured in a new episode of the PBS series After Action, sharing veterans' experiences before, during, and after their service. The episode is set to debut on Monday, November 10th. You can learn more and check your local airtimes at pbs.org. Switching gears now, local lawmakers in New York are urging Governor Hochul to sign legislation streamlining the recertification process for a program centering minority and women-owned businesses in the construction industry. WAMC's Sagina Shrestha reports.
The Minority and Women-Owned Business Enterprise Certification Program is a statewide program that expands business opportunities for minority and women business owners. Contractors on a state-funded project are required by New York State regulation to meet a 30% MWBE participation goal. As a result, chances to win bids for public work jobs improve for subcontractors certified as MWBE. the MWBE certificate is highly beneficial and is valid for 5 years upon receipt. However, according to local lawmakers, the recertification process for this program has become vague and confusing, costing business owners time and money. According to the state senator, Michelle Hinchey, the recertification process has not just become tedious, but also degrading.
It's also just, quite frankly, pretty demeaning, especially for our women business owners, at least from what we heard here, of people within the system questioning their qualifications, questioning if they could possibly know how to run a general contracting firm or know anything about the construction industry, for example. That's ludicrous. And we shouldn't be putting our small businesses through that.
Hinchey recently attended a roundtable discussion about the recertification process at the Capital Region Chamber of Commerce. One of the panelists was Elisa Cal Henderson, president of Duncan & Cal Incorporated in Troy. Her company is a general contractor that first became MWBE certified in 2010. This certification opened doors for the company, helping them work on multi-million dollar state projects, taking on smaller chunks of the contract to install parts of the project. Seeing this as a benefit, Henderson recertified in 2013 and 2017. However, when time came for Henderson's company to recertify in 2021, she ran into roadblocks and barriers that cost her a total of $6,000. Her latest recertification process, after the certificate was extended from 3 years to five, included confusing questions.
The recertification process, we filled everything out like we usually do, and I started... It was probably a year's worth of questions, you know. What jobs, I had to give them all the requisitions from the jobs that I ran. I had to send in things I had signed. I mean, it was minuscule, sort of crazy stuff. I was running this company. Never had a phone call, never had a question, or never had anybody visit, but just these questions. So the questions started to get, more vague, more, I didn't know what they were searching for.
Not understanding the purpose of the questions, Henderson went to her attorney, who helped her file for recertification. After a year of answering questions and filling out every document, Henderson's request for recertification was denied. When she and her lawyer appealed the denial, the process got even more confusing.
So then I went back to the lawyer, and we had to appeal within 30 days. I mean, the first letter, the dates didn't match when I had to get in, so I called. I got a solid date I had to have it in by. She applied for the appeal. Then you have to apply for a FOIL to get all the information that they have back. I asked for a virtual interview rather than a recertification by or an appeal by paper. So I asked for a virtual, but I was never asked to attend a virtual, and then I received my recertification.
After an additional 9 months of this process, Henderson was finally recertified again. According to lawmakers, Henderson's story is not the outlier, it is the norm. Business owners often spend time and money outside of their daily work to apply, answer, and appeal for their recertification. Citing these hassles, Hinchey and Assemblymember John McDonald introduced a bill streamlining the recertification process. The bill, which passed both the State Senate and the State Assembly, now awaits Governor Hochul's signature and would make it easier for businesses to become recertified if there has been no change in ownership or material change in management. McDonald said this new process, which would make it easier by automatically recertifying qualifying businesses, is a productive way for the state to make sure its goals are being met.
We think it makes perfect sense because, quite honestly, the state has set some very high goals for minority and women-owned business participation. Sometimes 25-30% of the job. The state needs these firms to be active and engaged and working and doing a public work. And it's kind of self-defeating when you have one agency of the state basically putting these longtime businesses in a purgatory where they really don't know their status.
For WAMC News, I'm Sajina Shrestha.
Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. The night air down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool. Sweet melting lips.